from Oklahoma to Virginia, Tennessee to Minnesota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has heard a Montana case that could have a profound impact on parental school choice options. Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation joins us with details. President Trump has signed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, fulfilling a key campaign promise. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. School choice is also an issue on the campaign trail, where Senator Elizabeth Warren has found it to be challenging. Eric Boehm and Corey DeAngelis of Reason Magazine report. And in the aftermath of the Civil War, Frederick Douglass was the voice of reason who brought us back together. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says such a voice will be needed when the impeachment saga ends. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A canceled Montana scholarship program has resulted in a major case heard in January by the Supreme Court that will determine whether the withholding of generally available public funds from parents wishing to send their children to religious-affiliated schools violated their constitutional rights. For details, we turn to Elizabeth Slattery, who is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Elizabeth, the case Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue could be a landmark case when it comes to securing the rights of parents to use really their tax dollars to help pay for their children's education. Tell us a little bit about the background of the case.
Back in 2015, the Montana legislature created a tax scholarship program that would provide scholarships for income-eligible kids to use at qualified private schools. So taxpayers would get a modest tax credit of up to $150 per year if they made a donation to this organization. And then the organization would give out scholarships to kids who applied, and then the kids and their families would decide what school to use them at. So when the program was first set up, the state originally allowed parents to select religious schools in addition to secular private schools. But then a couple years in, the Department of Revenue recognized that there is a state constitutional provision in Montana that says that no public funds can be used to aid religious organizations. So the state decided to issue an administrative rule saying that funds were limited to secular private schools. So a group of parents who had kids at religious schools who were relying on these scholarships sued in state court, and it went all the way up to the Montana Supreme Court, which decided in ruling against the parents that they were going to invalidate the program in its entirety so that no scholarship funds could be used for any private schools.
This theory that no public funds can be used for private schools of any type, known as Blaine Amendments to various state constitutions. Before we get back to the case of Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue, let's talk about these Blaine Amendments for a minute. Are they an issue in this case, and is it really unconstitutional to have that sort of blanket ban?
Blaine Amendments are named for a senator, Senator James Blaine, from the 1800s. He tried to get the U.S. Constitution amended to prohibit public funds from aiding what he called sectarian schools. Now, the motivation behind this was sort of an anti-Catholic bias. This was around the time that there was a wave of Irish Catholic immigrants coming to this country. And unfortunately for Senator Blaine, but fortunately for the federal constitution, that amendment failed. Now, a number of states decided to pass their own Blaine amendments and amend their constitutions. A number of states have these, I think 37 or 38 states, and they really bump up against school choice efforts because it's limiting in where parents can decide to send their children and use their dollars for where to send their children to school. And this is an issue in the case that's at the Supreme Court. It's an issue that's come up before. And, you know, Justice Clarence Thomas has written about the anti-Catholic bias and background of Blaine Amendments, and that he said, he has a great line, he says, born of bigotry, these amendments should be buried now.
Therefore, they are part of the current conversation. So let's now return This Espinoza case goes before the Supreme Court of the United States. And was the issue of Blaine amendments part of the oral arguments? Was that a component of that case when it hit the Supreme Court?
Yes, the Supreme Court heard oral argument earlier in January, and the issue of Blaine amendments in general did come up a number of times. And in particular, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, she gave sort of a speech at the oral argument talking about there were perfectly legitimate reasons for having Blaine amendments. But one of the lawyers explained that if you go back and look at history, this is not what our founders intended with the First Amendment. They didn't want religious organizations to be denied generally available benefits just because of their religious character, their religious identity. An issue that came up a number of times was, well, if the court rules for the parents here, does this mean that states are required to give money to religious schools? But nobody is arguing that. The argument simply is that if states decide to open up a program where they're going to allow parents to use money at private schools, you know, through tax credit or school vouchers or whatever sort of program they have, they can't then discriminate and say you can't use it at religious schools. If they decide to make funds available, then they need to allow it for private, for secular and religious schools.
Part of the argument that's being made here on behalf of Espinoza and the right of parents, taxpayers, to secure their own money for their children is that there are a couple of constitutional issues here. Can you talk briefly about those?
This is something that came up at the argument about, you know, whose constitutional right is actually being asserted here. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg suggested that the parents weren't actually the appropriate party to bring this challenge and that maybe the religious schools should be bringing this challenge. And while the religious schools certainly could have a claim, the parents have a direct financial injury. They're being penalized for their free exercise of religion in deciding that they want to send their children to religious schools because of the religious identity of those schools.
Also, in terms of the Constitution, since the Constitution says that you cannot prevent the free exercise of religion, is that a component of this case as well, that these parents, if they wish to send their child to a school that is religiously affiliated, they have the right to exercise that right?
Yes, that is a central component of the parents' claim. And a central part of that is that going back to a 2017 ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court that dealt with a daycare center that was run by a church, it was excluded from applying for a grant to resurface its playground simply because the daycare was run by a church. And the Supreme Court in that case said you can't discriminate against an organization and say either give up your religious identity or you can't apply for generally available public funds. And it's a similar sort of situation with this case. And so I think the parents are hoping that the court will extend the logic of that ruling from the daycare center from a couple of years ago to this area with school choice.
Where does this go to from here? There's been oral arguments. Are we now going to just be awaiting a ruling from the high court?
Yes, a ruling could come in the next couple of months. Most likely, we will see something by the end of June when the current term wraps up.
We have been talking with Elizabeth Slattery, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about Heritage and where can folks go to learn more?
The Heritage Foundation is a public policy organization. We come up with conservative solutions for policy problems, and you can find out more at heritage.org.
Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation. Elizabeth, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson is in Washington, D.C., and there are things going on beside the impeachment drama, one of which is the President of the United States this past week signed the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. And Scott, you were there for the signing. Tell us what was the mood, and as we look at this agreement, give us some of the key points.
Sort of to frame the situation here, this is obviously in the middle of a key week of the impeachment drama in the United States Senate. And I was very fortunate and honored to receive an invitation to the signing ceremony for the USMCA trade agreement. And I'll tell you, President Trump was in he seemed to be in a very good mood. He was joking with the crowd. He had just a lot of one-liners. And when he gets in and riffs off the cuff, he can do a, a pretty good performance, right? He is a performer and he connects with people in that fashion. So it was pretty neat. There were roughly 100 members of the House of Representatives and I'd say about 20 senators attended. And the president made a joke at the beginning. He's like, well, I better acknowledge every single senator that's here because, of course, I need their vote. And so he went through the long list of Republicans that were there and asked each of them to stand up. The bottom line is he also made a key point that is there were about 400 dignitaries and key members of our government, the cabinet, the president's family were all in attendance. And he did say that the most important people there were the ones that were standing right behind him. And of course, he was represented by key workers and business interests for the United States of America. And, you know, you're talking about farmers and the energy sector and key labor industries. And obviously, that's what this trade agreement aims to do, is to improve the economic viability for the U.S. to be competitive and to not really be ripped off by Canada, especially, and then hopefully to strengthen the economic relationships with both Mexico and Canada.
Coming on the heels of the new Phase 1 China trade agreement a couple of weeks ago, Scott, is it fair to say now that the president has, in 3 short years, literally completely redrawn the map when it comes to trade?
This was one of the campaign pillars from 2016. He promised the forgotten voter in the Rust Belt that he was going to renegotiate and use his business experience to change the way that American industry has basically been dying throughout the country when it comes to manufacturing and farmers and agriculture. You're seeing a fulfillment of that promise. Obviously, what's going on with China, that's phase one. There needs to be additional phases to roll back the tariffs. But it is progress, and the president believes that our relationship with China is stronger than ever. So we're watching closely to see exactly what phase two might look like. We're strongly encouraging the president to finally roll back all the tariffs that he's laid on China, because ultimately we believe that those are taxes on the U.S. consumer. We are also in the posture where President Trump, with redoing these trade agreements, right, if you think about three legs of a stool, you've got his economic agenda. And one of the first legs is definitely trade. Another one is tax cuts, and another one is his deregulatory agenda. And it's out this week that the economy in the last quarter once again grew at, I think, 2.1%, which is still decent comparatively to the last decade. You know, the Trump economy is strong. Unemployment is incredibly low. Labor participation continues to rise. And I think Americans are actually feeling quite confident. Consumer confidence is high. And so when you look at the combination of the stock market and you look at new certainty surrounding trade deals, and you look at tax cuts and deregulation, people are feeling pretty good about taking risk and being entrepreneurial and growing the U.S. economy.
Let's switch gears now from trade to politics and go to the Peach State, the state of Georgia, where a very interesting Republican primary is shaping up. Set the stage and tell us what's happening there.
Long-term United States Senator Johnny Isaacson, last year he announced his retirement. And his retirement was effective at the end of the session of Congress. So what you saw was, on one hand, you had the president that was encouraging Governor Kemp down in Georgia to go with one candidate, and dozens of people actually applied through a public process to be the next senator from Georgia. In the end, Brian Kemp chose Kelly Loeffler, she's now the United States Senator. She's serving here in Washington. And what we saw this week was Congressman Doug Collins, the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, threw his hat in the ring and is announcing a primary challenge to Kelly Loeffler. Club for Growth has announced a $3 million issue advocacy ad blitz against Doug Collins, given his poor record on economic freedom and liberty. Mr. Collins has time and time again voted for these bloated budgets and really high levels of spending, irresponsible levels. And in the end, he is a large part of why these deals get through. He's an incredibly powerful member of the House, and we think that there's no role for him in the United States Senate. So in 2018, Doug Collins had a 56% on the Club for Growth Foundation's annual scorecard. We are currently tabulating our 2019 scores, so we'll be releasing that within the next couple months. And I'll certainly be telling your listeners all about the key races and how current incumbents are doing.
And we, of course, will be keeping a close eye on the U.S. Senate election in Georgia, as we will states all across the country. And in weeks ahead, we're going to start having primaries. So we'll be talking about the states individually. In the meantime, again, Scott Parkinson with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and we have members from all 50 states in the union. 350,000 members belong to the Club for Growth. Our membership is united in liberty and freedom, economic opportunity, and so if anybody's interested in checking us out, you can actually become a member for free of the Club for Growth. Our website is www.clubforgrowth.org, and on Twitter, we're at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Candidates who send their own children to private schools but deny school choice to others are finding the hypocrisy hard to explain. Eric Boehm and Corey DeAngelis of Reason Magazine find Elizabeth Warren to be one such candidate.
You know, it really drives me crazy whenever politicians oppose choice and freedom and the ability of parents and children to choose the school that is best for them. But it really gets me going. Well, for one, it really gets me going during National School Choice Week, of which we are at the very end of right now. And it also really gets me going when those same politicians talk so much about having to fix inequality in America, when people like, for example, Senator Elizabeth Warren want to address inequality, but then, oh, no, no, we can't do that through the school system, even though education is one of the main drivers of inequality. And that is what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice at the Reason Foundation. He's a colleague of mine. He's over on the think tank side of the operation. I work for the magazine, but we all get along pretty well. Corey, thanks for taking some time and being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. Glad to have you. We're going to talk a little bit about Elizabeth Warren and some personal issues involving her track record with school choice. But before we get into that, if you can, just sort of give us a sense of where she stands on school choice, because most Democrats are not big fans of charter schools and vouchers and things like that. But Warren really kind of stands out from the crowd.
Oh, she's radically anti-choice. Some education reporters that actually argued that her anti-school choice stance is even more extreme than Bernie Sanders' anti-school choice stance. And just to summarize really quickly, she calls to end federal funding of public charter schools, calls to tack on more regulations of public charter schools to make them more difficult to run and to operate. And then also she calls to for more regulations to open new public charter schools. She also called to, in her education plan, end tax credit scholarship programs and to end voucher programs in the United States. So these are radical ideas against private and public school choice.
Yeah, and we should say that, I mean, look, what Warren has put out in her proposal, it's not clear how that would intersect with state and local policy. I mean, most voucher programs, most charter schools, these are not federally run things, with the exception of the D.C. voucher program, which is. And so it's a little bit unclear exactly what she would want to do here. But what is more clear, Corey, is something that you've actually had a hand in uncovering, and that is this sort of disconnect between Warren's policies regarding school choice, or her preferred policies, and her own track record here. Tell us a little bit about what you've found.
Oh, yes, definitely. So just a few months ago, she released her education plan, and she came out pretty hard against school choice, like I said. In the same time, she started tweeting a lot, and she even started a new hashtag, Public School Proud. And she started telling everyone how she was proud that she went to public schools in Oklahoma, that she was proud to have taught at public schools in the United States. but she left out details about where she sent her own children to school. Education Week actually did an analysis of all of the Democratic presidential candidates in May of 2019 and just asked them where they went to school and where their kids went to school. And Warren actually responded to them and said that, you know, she taught at public schools and that she went to public schools herself, but her campaign said, we're not going to respond for comment on where Warren sent her own kids to school. So that raised a little bit of a red flag for me, and I started looking into it, and you couldn't find any of these details online until I went to Ancestry.com and looked up and found that Alex Warren, her son, went to an expensive private school in Austin at the time that Elizabeth Warren was teaching at UT Austin. It's called Kirby Hall School, and the tuition currently is around $18,000 per student. Other sources, after I found that out, figured out that Alex Warren also went to the Haverford School in Pennsylvania, another elite private school.
There's clearly a track record here, right? Because this is, it's different, but it's certainly similar in some ways to the incident that she's now gotten in trouble for over lying about or exaggerating her own Native American heritage at Harvard Law. And it just seems like a similar sort of thing, like taking advantage of privilege, but then not letting others do it in the case of her school choice, in the case of her stance on school choice. We are talking with Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice for the Reason Foundation, and he joins us on the phone now. Corey, we only have about a minute left here, but I wonder if we could just sort of zoom out. Big picture, what does this tell us about Warren as a person? Because this is, it's more than just a hypocritical policy stance. This is about sort of, you know, taking advantage of something and then not letting others do the same thing.
Yeah, so essentially it's obviously okay for her to send her own kids to private schools and for her grandkids to attend private schools as well, but then she fights really hard about extending similar options to the least advantaged in society when it comes to K-12 education. And it becomes even more hypocritical and strange when you also point out the fact that these same politicians like Warren, who oppose school choice at the K-12 level, support school choice when it comes to higher ed or pre-K programs, because when they're pushing for Pell Grants, for example, Pell Grants can be used at a private or public school of choice. When you have a pre-K program in a particular state, those funds can typically be used at a public or private school of choice. And it's just strange and inconsistent for Warren and other politicians like Warren to come out against school choice between the years of pre-K and college.
Yeah, and as I said at the top, it really just drives me crazy when you have politicians that talk about inequality and the need to address inequality, and then, well, they don't support school choice, so then what? That's one of the main drivers of inequality in America is education, and you just can't take you seriously if you're not going to get on board with that. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Corey DeAngelis from the Reason Foundation, really fantastic work here. Thank you for bringing this to light, and thank you for joining us today on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And again, that is Corey DeAngelis. You can check out his work at reason.org. That's .org at the end. That's the think tank, the Reason Foundation. You can check out my work at reason.com. I am Eric Boehm for Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal, and catch me right back here next week.
Impeachment has polarized the nation, but we're not nearly as divided as we were in the Civil War era. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says it will take a unique leader to bring us back together.
I am writing and recording this commentary on Thursday, January 30, and most of you will be hearing it on the weekend of February 1st and 2nd. By then, the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump may be over. Although Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was quoted on Tuesday night as saying that he did not have the votes to prevent the admission of additional witnesses and documents to the Senate trial, I suspect that he does, and that his statement that he doesn't is what is sometimes called a head fake, a deceptive move in one direction while actually intending to move in the opposite direction. Whether that speculation is correct or not, the entire impeachment process has provided a high-profile example of what I consider to be a deeply serious problem in our contemporary political culture. That problem was succinctly stated by management guru and author Ken Blanchard. Blanchard has written over 60 books, the most famous of which sold over 13 million copies, titled The One-Minute Manager. Blanchard's pithy statement of our current cultural conundrum is this: we have become increasingly divided into two warring win-lose camps. Some sociologists and political scientists refer to this as polarization, but Blanchard's short statement captures a reality that merely calling it polarization misses. The two camps or poles are not simply separated, they are at war with each other. Each one is obsessively committed to the utter obliteration of the other. Nowhere has this belligerence been more obvious than in the impeachment and trial of Donald Trump. Because the two warring camps are of roughly equal size, the likelihood that one of them could utterly obliterate the other while remaining intact itself is so remote as to be effectively impossible. But however divided we may be today, it is not nearly as intense or belligerent as in the 19th century when the Civil War claimed over 600,000 American lives. The Union forces' ultimate victory in that war did not usher in an immediate era of peace. The war was followed by the failure of Reconstruction and the regrettable Jim Crow era of legalized discrimination. Although vestiges of cultural division remain to this day, it was the emergence of leaders like Frederick Douglass that began the process of national healing. As we pass through the impeachment process and begin the month often referred to as Black History Month, what can we learn from Frederick Douglass's leadership that can help us reunite in the 21st century? Although he was a fierce and uncompromising abolitionist before the war, and an equally outspoken and unambiguous advocate for racial equality after the war, Douglass saw in the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution the common ideals whose pursuit could draw us together rather than apart. Where is the leader today who is trying to bring us together by rearticulating the ideals that have arguably made the United States the most successful and enduring experiment in self-government in all of human history? Where is the leader who is willing to stand between Ken Blanchard's two warring camps and lift them above their obsession with obliterating each other and instead knit us together in common purpose and common hopes? Where is the leader whose faith in God requires him or her to be a leader with humility rather than hubris? Is there one in the United States Senate, sometimes referred to as the world's greatest deliberative body, who possesses these qualities? Keep your eyes on the ones who don't try to spin people into partisan rages like Chuck Schumer. Try to tune in to senators like Tim Scott, James Lankford, and Ben Sasse. Look for a 21st century Frederick Douglass. Look for a leader whose humility is the necessary result of faith in God rather than self. They won't be the ones rushing to the microphones and TV studios, but they may be what America needs to lift us out of the dysfunction that Ken Blanchard has so succinctly described. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WFCA-AM in French Camp, Mississippi, WXLI-AM and FM in Dublin, Georgia, and WMAN-AM in Mansfield, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.